This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. For the rest of the year, we will be revisiting some of the best interviews from the series from 2018. On this episode themed Wildlife Warriors, we look back at stories of individuals who are dedicated to helping threatened wildlife populations. First up, we revisit an interview with Mariani Ramli, the advisor for the Gibbon Protection Society of Malaysia and the project manager for the Gibbon Rehabilitation Project, and Dr. Susan Lappin, a visiting Fulbright researcher at the School of Biological Sciences, USM Malaysia, who joined us back in June to discuss gibbon conservation. Here's a short snippet of them explaining the threats that gibbons face and what happens when they are held in captivity.
The threats for gibbons in the wild is one, if this deforestation, mm-hmm. and then second, and the most concerning now is illegal pet trade. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So they shoot, normally the poachers or the hunters, they will aim for the baby gibbons. But to take the baby gibbons, they need to kill the parents.
Right.
Because gibbons is the only monogamous primate. Like human, they are consist father, mother, and couple of siblings. That's all. They are not like macaque. Macaque live in a big family, like 20 or 30 of them.
Sure.
But gibbons, they stay in a family together in the jungle. Like only 5 or maximum 6 of them. So they protect each other. Mm-hmm. So when their young baby been threatened, all of them will protect them. And of course, for the poachers to get the baby, the others will be killed. That's why they are like easily to extinct, I can say. Mm-hmm. Because even from one bird to another bird, it takes like 3 to 4 years.
Right. Okay. They don't reproduce every year as such.
Sure. Right.
Okay.
And they also take a very long time to grow up.
Yeah.
So for example, sea mungs are the species I've studied the longest, so I tend to focus on them in conversations. But it takes a female about 10 years to reach reproductive maturity,
okay.
which is astonishingly long for such a small animal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a sea mung is only about 11 kilos, so the size of kind of a medium-sized dog that's going to grow up in, what, a year and a half and be able to have a litter every, mm-hmm. you know, every few months really.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you know, for a gibbon, if it takes them 8 to 10 years to grow up, and then a female can have one baby every 2.5, 3, 4 years. Not all of those babies survive.
Mm-hmm.
What this means is, first of all, the females are incredibly important. If you kill one female, it takes 10 years to grow another one.
Yes. Yeah.
And each infant lost represents at least one female loss, because they always kill the mother. That's how they get the baby.
The
they shoot her, she falls. Sometimes they kill the baby too, so then they have to kill another mother. And when transporting those infants, the infants are stressed, sometimes injured. So most of the infants that they capture don't make it to the market. So one infant being sold as a pet represents several other dead infants and that many dead mothers as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is the kind of losses that, because of their very slow reproduction, they can't sustain.
Mm-hmm.
What this also means is that it's difficult to get a sense of how they're doing in the wild, because their reproduction happens at such a slow rate that the fact that there are adults out there doesn't mean that they're replacing themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They have very long lifespans. So this is one of the things that as an ecologist I worry about, that when we see that there are gibbons in a forest, we tend to think, okay, that's good, they're still there. But that doesn't mean that they're reproducing at replacement rates.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that we can go out and hear gibbons still singing in the forest, especially in degraded forests, doesn't necessarily mean that those represent healthy populations.
So what actually happens when you start keeping a wild animal in your house? I mean, how does that start to affect the gibbons?
Okay. Just to add a bit about the Act, actually gibbons are totally protected species under the Wildlife Conservation Act 2010-716. So if you keep juvenile gibbons, baby gibbons at home,
mm-hmm.
you can be charged until R200,000 and jail 10 years. Normally, these gibbons, when they're still young, the owner will bring them everywhere, brought
sure.
them everywhere. But when they started to grow, like two years old or 3 years old, they become so active, because their wild home range is like 2 to 3 kilometers. Can you imagine your house is how many feet,
yeah.
and your car and your room? So when they feel like confined, they started to become stress, demotivate. Some of them start become crazy. Mm-hmm. They pull their own hair. There's also biting their own hand. Or they do like self-harming, any self-harming that can, they don't have any motivation to live anymore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
And you've seen this for yourself. You have actually rescued gibbons who were kept as pets.
Yes.
Maybe you can share some of your experiences of some of the gibbons that you've rescued.
There's one case of gibbons. His name is Daru. He's been kept in a small cage. Like he's only been fed once or twice a week. When he was young, he was still cute and the owner still liked him. But when he was big, he decided to like put him in a cage and yeah. And then the owner kids, they poke him in the with stick. And that made Daru become crazy.
Of course.
He bit his own arm. He pulled his own hair. Yeah, he became a crazy gibbon. He just want to kill himself. Mm-hmm. But now, after 4 years, it's a bit hard because when I rescued Daru, he don't even want to eat because he don't used to eat. He's been fed one or twice
a week.
Food is not important for him. So mm-hmm. I need to treat him psychologically, and I want to make him eat. That's the most important thing. I want him to eat first before I can do other treatment. But yeah, for now it's more than four years now. He started to sing. He have like thick coat. He's so active. He's like he like to show off his his body. He's in a good condition now.
Okay, all right. But I mean, when you found him, obviously, like you said, he was trying to kill himself because you know they're wild animals. They're not supposed to be kept in cages.
Yes,
if you compare the life that an animal has in captivity with the life in the wild, mm-hmm. as Bam said. A young gibbon will be carried by their mother basically all of the time. Mm-hmm. For the first 6 months or so of life, they'll start to explore a little bit, but they'll still be with mom for the first, say, 2 years, maybe with dad if they're a Siamang. They also have quite good fathers. But they become much more independent after that. But they're independent within the context of a social group. Mm-hmm. So that being confined is a stressor. Being alone is another stressor. Mm-hmm. Gibbons in the wild are never alone. They're with a family all the time. Mm-hmm. From the moment they're born, they're with their parents. Groups are very cohesive. They travel together through the forest. They make little soft vocalizations to each other in addition to the big songs that they sing. So even when they can't see each other, they know there's someone there. Mm-hmm. Now imagine being locked in a cage and left alone all day. Being tied in the yard and left alone all day. They are not cut out for this. This is not the kind of life they were meant to have. They're meant to be playing, climbing, exploring. Yeah. Wild gibbons don't just play with their family members. They play with other species too. They play with monkeys. They play with, I've seen them batting at flying squirrels just to make them fly through the forest. So they're these incredibly curious and playful social animals, and to lock them alone in a cage has about the same effect that locking a human being alone in a cage has. It makes them crazy.
And gibbons is the king of breakation. They are the king of swinger. They're the fastest primates in the world. So you put them in a cage, they cannot sing anymore, and they cannot swing anymore.
Yeah.
So yeah, it will be such a.
It's torture, essentially.
Yeah, it's a torture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And the ones that were fortunate enough to be found, the ones that you have rehabilitated, is there? I mean. How likely are they to go back into the wild? Is there a possibility of that?
Yeah, it depends on the history of each gibbons.
Sure.
And if the more traumatic they are, it will take longer time. Mm-hmm. But for now, the gibbons is under my care. All of them have potential to be released, but they need to release the gibbons into the wild again. They need to fulfill 8 criteria. Mm-hmm. They need to know how to sing. They need how to brachiate. They don't have any like injuries, like handicap.
Sure. Because I mean, they've been through so much, right? You don't actually know what the history is sometimes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it takes like 5 to 10 years to rehabilitate one individual. Yeah,
that's a long time. What is their lifespan again, sorry?
That's a really good question. They live so long that we're not sure how long they live in the wild. Okay. There are wild individuals that are known to be 30 or more years old, or at least estimated to be that based on how long we've been, not me myself, but you know, scientists have been following them. In captivity, they can live 40 years. So these are very long-lived animals. This long, slow lifespan also relates to the problem of rehabilitation, because In the wild, they have a period of 8 to 10 years where they're essentially learning skills from their families.
Yes.
So you can't just, I think people often have this idea, oh, when I'm done with this pet, I'll just let them go.
Yeah.
They won't go. They don't know how to go. Yeah, they don't know how to avoid predators. They don't know how to find food. They don't know how to find a social group. They don't know how to move. They've been on the ground their whole life. They don't know how to move around in the trees. So as Bam was saying, you have to essentially teach them all the things that their family would normally have taught them in the wild before there's any possibility of releasing them.
That was Mariani Ramli, the advisor for the Gibbon Protection Society of Malaysia and the project manager for the Gibbon Rehabilitation Project, and Dr. Susan Lappin, a visiting Fulbright researcher at the School of Biological Sciences in USM Malaysia, who joined us back in June to discuss gibbon conservation. To listen to that interview in full, you can search for the podcast titled Gibbon A Chance. I do apologize for my love of bad puns. And after this quick break, we will discuss the threats faced by the Tapanuli apes. You are listening to Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is our Best of Earth Matters special, and today we are looking at wildlife warriors. So last year, the world was amazed by the news that a new species of orangutan, the Tapanuli orangutan, was found in Batang Toru in Sumatra. Unfortunately, researchers believe that only fewer than 800 of these animals are surviving in a tiny tract of forest. Listed as critically endangered by the IUCN, the Tapanuli orangutans are now facing a more dangerous threat in the form of the Chinese-funded Batang Toru Hydropower Project. We caught up with distinguished Professor William Lawrence, the director of the Centre for Tropical, Environmental and Sustainability Science at the James Cook University in Australia, and a member of ALERT, the Alliance of Leading Environmental Researchers and Thinkers, to find out more.
Yeah, that was quite an extraordinary result. A team of scientists last year published a paper where they discovered that this isolated population of orangutans was actually a completely different species than the other orangutans. And so it turned out that it's this tiny, but completely, and in every way you look at it, genetically, in terms of its body, its shape, its behavior, its calls, everything about it is completely different from the other species of orangutans, and it only occurs in this very tiny area, which is about a tenth the size of Sydney, Australia, for example, just a little tiny patch of forest, and there's only about 800 of these apes left in the world. And when we looked in detail at where it occurs, guess what we found? When roads appear, it disappears. Mm-hmm. So it's deforestation and logging and poaching and illegal mining, all that, just wipe it out. So it's sitting here barely clinging to survival. It's now been officially rated as critically endangered by IUCN, the International Union for Conservation of Nature, which is the worst category of all. After critically endangered, the only thing left after that is extinct. And what's happening is that China, as part of its gigantic Belt and Road Initiative, which of course is going to be this massive tsunami of about 7,000 different road and railroad and highway and other kinds of infrastructure and extractive industry projects, as part of this Belt and Road program of China, they want to build a hydro project right in the heart of the range of this tiny ape. And what it would basically do was cut in half its tiny little population with roads and power line corridors and with a 10-meter diameter pipeline, and as well as flooding a key area of the ape's remaining habitat. So we think this is just environmental insanity. And there's no way, in fact, we've already gotten documentation from the World Bank and from the Asian Development Bank that they wouldn't touch this area. They knew how important it was, and they have no interest, in fact, in working there or really in the looser area because of how critical they are. And yet what we're seeing is very aggressive Chinese developers, and this includes the Bank of China, which comes directly under President Xi Jinping's cabinet, and it includes Sinohydro, which is China's national hydro development authority, and other Chinese financiers. So this has China's fingerprints and handprints and footprints all over it, and they are absolutely driving 100% full speed ahead, and they are not, they're doing everything they can to fight this and not back off. And they're, if it had been known that that ape was there and it was a unique species, there's no way in a, anywhere in the world that that would ever be approved. Mm-hmm. And what we're trying to say now, they haven't started the dam yet, but they've just started to do some initial forest clearing.
True.
We're saying it makes no sense at all. It makes, I mean, it's absolutely, as I said, it's sort of an environmental Armageddon to be putting a project like that in that place. And, but what's happening is that the Chinese company and their Indonesian partners are fighting tooth and nail to continue this project. And really our view is this, if this is emblematic of what the BRI, what the Belt and Road Initiative is going to stand for, the 7,000 projects, and we hear President Xi Jinping saying, oh, it's going to be green and it's going to be circular and it's going to be sustainable. If that's what's going to happen, if what's happening with this Tapanuli orangutan, only the seventh species of great ape even known on the whole planet Earth, mm-hmm. one of our closest relatives, if it's going to be, if they're willing to sacrifice that for really quite a modest economic benefit and for a modest amount of power generation, then what else could you say about any of the 7,000 other Belt and Road projects? And how are we to believe anything that we're hearing coming out, quite frankly, out of the Chinese government about the Belt and Road Initiative? And I think that that's what makes that particular story so much more significant. Yes, it's one of our closest relatives. Yes, there's only 800 individuals left alive. It's right on the edge of extinction. And yes, there's a Chinese project that's going to go in and really could be a dagger in the heart of this species. But the bigger thing is that it is part of the Belt and Road, which China is pushing, which will affect 70 different nations across the world and $8 trillion of funding if it happens the way it's currently planned. No one will be unaffected by that. And if China will not back off from that project, then one has difficulty imagining any project that they would move away from because of environmental or indeed possibly social concerns about the project.
And you said that they're actually using misinformation to advance their case, that, you know, the environmental and social impact assessments that they did was, well, you know, a bit of a sham.
Well, this is not unusual, actually. If you look at a lot of environmental impact assessments, which we have mm-hmm. around the world, what you see is that in many cases, they're extremely superficial mm-hmm. and short-term and very, very weak in many instances. But what's happening to make this worse, and I think this is what is, you know, probably what is getting a lot of scientists around the world very annoyed right now, is the fact that they are advancing these extremely weak and really ridiculous arguments of trying to say, oh, well, you know, we can put in these roads and power lines and giant pipelines, and we can chop the ape's habitat in half, and it'll all be fine, don't you worry, and we'll put in a little corridor, and we'll do a little, you know, a little bit of this, and we'll plant a few trees, and it'll all be fine. And we've been around, I've been doing this for almost 40 years, and I'm telling you, we've seen this happen again and again, and what we know happens in these areas, again, is this, you put in the roads, and what you see is a Pandora's box of other impacts, poaching, deforestation, illegal logging, fires, haze. It just happens again and again. So I absolutely, we will destroy, scientifically, we can destroy the argument that that company is making, and really what it's doing, I think it's just reducing the credibility of Sinohydro and the Bank of China and the Chinese proponents. And as I've said before, they shouldn't be walking away from this project. They should be running away from it. It is that bad. And again, I'm a scientist. We're trained not to use a lot of dramatic language, but this is one of these cases where we're talking about one of the rarest animals left on the planet, yeah. and one of the few species of great apes, and a project that would be very possibly the death knell of this, and a project that would never be approved. Hardly, it's hard to imagine any other nation in the world where a project like this would go ahead. And yet here we see China pushing ahead with as much power as it possibly can. And we're seeing the Indonesian proponents also doing everything they can to try to advance this. And I think it says some unfortunate things about this area and quite possibly that they simply just don't understand the magnitude of the problem, and they don't understand what they're doing and saying. It's easy to say green, and it's easy to say it's going to be sustainable and circular, but in reality, those words are just greenwashing. They're meaningless if they're not really also associated with the critical actions.
And what actions are you, the scientists, taking? I know that you've hand-delivered a letter to Joko Widodo. You know, what else are you doing, and how can we actually help?
Well, right now, that is, we published a scientific paper. We put out a press release. We're, of course, talking to media. But we published a few follow-up articles. And right now, you know, increasingly, it ultimately comes down to it's in the hands of the Indonesian people. Sure. And in the people in the provinces of North Sumatra and in Aceh in Indonesia, and in the government of Indonesia's hands. I mean, that's a sovereign nation. Of course, it has to make its own decisions. But of course, we have many Indonesians. We have Indonesians that key Indonesian scientists that signed that scientist letter to President Jokowi. We have many, many people we know across Indonesia that are very worried about this issue and about the broader trends of exploitative and predatory development that they are concerned about. But all we can really do right now is talk about it, mm-hmm. and then hope that the government of Indonesia, you know, has the wisdom and the long-sighted attitude to hopefully try to stop this. And in particular, stopping the project with the Tapanuli ape, I think that would be a dagger in the heart of that species. And there's just no way to get around that. Again, I think if that proceeds, that will tell us an awful lot about China and its actions and intentions, and unfortunately about Indonesia's capacity to sustain and manage really the last remnants of its absolutely critical ecosystems. And if you look at maps of Indonesia across the world, what you see in terms of hot spots of biodiversity and hot spots of environmentally critical ecosystems, Indonesia is just about the brightest glowing country in the world, and this is just about the brightest glowing part of Indonesia in terms of being really environmentally critical. So I hope the right thing happens here, but right now I just don't know. There's very powerful forces at work that have a lot of money and power.
That was part of the interview about the Tapanuli orangutan and the threats they are facing. If you'd like to hear that interview in full, do look for the podcast titled Damning the Tapanuli Apes to Death. Yes, sorry, the bad puns continue at bfm.my/earth. We stop for another quick break, but when we return, we hear more about the battle to save tigers, specifically the Malayan tiger, from extinction. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Welcome back. This is Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture. I'm Juliet Jacobs. For the rest of the year, we'll be revisiting some of the best interviews from the series from 2018. Our theme for today, Wildlife Warriors. And now we're going to hear from Dr. Mark Ryan Damaraj, who spearheads the World Wild Fund for Nature, WWF's Tiger Landscape. And he joined us back in July in conjunction with Global Tiger Day. In essence, our tiger numbers are still dwindling here in Malaysia, despite our best efforts. And here's Mark sharing more.
I think tigers, regardless whether in Malaysia or elsewhere, are basically threatened by habitat loss, which is basically conversion of the habitat of its forests. Fragmentation by infrastructure, for example, like roads. Degradation by logging as well. But the main threat is basically poaching. Poaching of tigers and their prey. A lot of people don't consider the second factor, which is poaching of prey. But it has a huge impact in terms of trying to sustain a good tiger population. Mm-hmm. So if the prey numbers go down, the reproduction of tigers also go down.
Of course.
But essentially poaching is the biggest threat for tigers everywhere.
Mm-hmm. And I think I just wanted to touch on the infrastructure bit. I mean, like, you know, how building roads actually affects their crossings, for example, or their, you know, trying to get from one place to the other, essentially. And I think everyone remembers this story, was it a year or 2 years ago, where a pregnant tiger was actually killed by a vehicle of some sort, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean that's just a direct mortality, mm-hmm. If a vehicle knocks down a tiger. But, I mean, if you look at the long-term effects of roads, basically, over time, if there are a lot of vehicles using the road, the animals will not cross.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is that the area becomes fragmented. Mm-hmm. If it becomes fragmented, then towards the long end, the long run, you would get a genetically unviable population. So they'd be segregated for a long period. And because of that, they'd be more susceptible to diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So, this is in terms of 100 years and so, you know. But, the effects can be actually quite devastating over the long run.
Mm-hmm. And I think another effect of roads is that it just makes it easier for poachers to get to them as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. So, in fact, actually, that's the more threatening factor when it comes to roads. Not only, the main roads, but also logging roads as well. When you've got logging inside, so poachers did not have access into the area before, now have access.
Mm-hmm.
It's typical that around the roads, you also find a lot of, development taking place as well. That's just inevitable.
Okay. And I guess, for someone who doesn't quite understand, why is it so important to preserve tigers? I mean, they are the apex predators, right? So how does that kind of fall into the whole conservation of the biodiversity in a particular area?
Right. If you're looking at it from an ecological point of view, tigers, like you said, are the apex predators. So they regulate the food chain. And what that means is that they regulate, the animals that eat vegetation. So like sambar deer, pigs, gao, that's the main prey.
Mm-hmm.
And, by having them there, they regulate the ecosystem balance within an area.
Mm-hmm.
If you remove them, you will not immediately find any effect, but over the long term, you would find a drastic change as well in terms of the habitat as well. A clear example would be the wolves in Yellowstone. They were eradicated in the late 1920s, and they were brought back, I think, in the late 90s. And, over the decade, over the seven decades, you could see a drastic change in the habitat. And when wolves were brought back, even the trajectory of where rivers used to flow have now come back to how it was before.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the overgrazed areas are now basically flourishing with vegetation.
Mm-hmm.
So, when people look at tigers being removed from an habitat, they can't really see it because, they're not there yet.
Yeah.
And it's very difficult to convince people of the ecological disaster that can happen.
Not such good news coming out. Despite all the conservation efforts that have been put in place to protect, well, I suppose specifically the Malayan tiger. What other stats do you have for us? What's happening? What's failing us in that sense?
Right. I guess my team and I work in the Belum Temenggu Forest Complex. Like I said, it's one of those out of three priority sites in Peninsular Malaysia. The other two are basically Taman Negara National Park and Endau Rompin Forest Complex in Johor and Pahang.
Mm-hmm.
So in Belum Temenggu, what we've been finding is a huge increase of snares that have been set by foreign poachers. So from 2014 to 2017, we found easily about 500 over snares in that area. And for people who don't know what a snare is, basically it's a cable that is tied in a loop and with a noose. And, as soon as you step on the trigger, if your foot gets caught in it, the tighter you pull, if you pull it, basically the noose becomes tighter and you will not be able to get out of it. So, you can imagine if you have 500 over snares in that area, not just tigers, but any other animal that is caught will eventually die. And so that's what's been happening in Belum Temenggu. And in terms of numbers, it really looks bleak because we have easily a 50% decline in the population of tigers in Belum Temenggu since the last time that we surveyed in 2009 and 2011.
Gosh.
So this is recent evidence that we have gathered. And it's mainly because of poaching.
I suppose it's for the illegal trade of tiger parts, right? Why does this even happen? Why are tiger parts so sought after?
Right. So the illegal wildlife trade is valued between $7 to $23 billion per year.
Mm-hmm.
So wildlife crime is the fourth most lucrative illegal business in the world after narcotics, human trafficking and weapons. And so as you can see, in the black market, each tiger could be valued at about $40,000 to $50,000 when it reaches the end buyer. And because it's so lucrative, people are willing to basically go all the way to, send people from one country to another. And you'd be surprised that, the majority of the poachers that come in are basically from Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia.
Right.
And this is because then no more tigers in those areas, and there's a huge demand. And but because it's so expensive, only the rich can pretty much afford it. And so it's more like a, you know, it becomes more like a status sort of a thing. But also, you know, a lot of people still believe that tiger and tiger parts as some traditional Chinese medicine properties. But I mean, scientifically, that's not been ever been proven.
Right.
And so, yeah, I mean, when there's a demand, basically, there'll be poaching and the trade of the species.
Okay, but there's been a lot of conservation efforts going on, right? What's not working then, I suppose, you know, because is it just too wide an area to cover? Is there just not enough manpower to kind of deal with poaching? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I think, for Malaysia, we have a lot of plans, actually, national plans.
Sure.
So we have the National Tiger Conservation Action Plan for Malaysia in 2008 till 2020. And the plan was basically to increase the number from 500 to 1,000. But, you know, we've halved it, basically. So we're down to 250 now. The main issue with that plan was that, you know, the resource mobilization as well as funding was not well thought through.
Sure.
So they were not allocated for that purpose. It's still a good plan, and we are in the midst of actually revising that plan. Apart from action plans and, you know, trying to save the habitat with the federal plans such as the Central Forest Pine, the main issue is basically poaching at the moment, right?
Right.
You know, a year ago when we had these initiatives called the One Malaysia Biodiversity Enforcement Operation Network, it's called One and Beyond, whereby the Department of Wildlife and National Parks and the Army would do several operations per year in the three priority sites. That was quite useful, but it was not a constant sort of operation. So, I mean, there are no rangers 24/7 in a particular area. And so, obviously, like what you said, the area is just too large and we don't have enough enforcement personnel on the ground to stop poaching as our first line of defense. To give you an example, Royal Bloom State Park is about 1,175 square kilometers. That's about twice the size of Singapore.
Mm-hmm.
And they have 12 rangers, which are 12. Not armed. Yes, 12 rangers that are not armed. But the rangers are also required to look at, you know, ecotourism, managing infrastructure as well. So there's actually not many people who are doing patrolling in the forest. And when you have such a situation, it's so easy to just come in and set snares and, you know, basically plunder our resources.
Right.
And that's the main problem that we see across Peninsula Malaysia.
Okay, and I know that Malaysian conservation leaders, you actually met just this month, I think, for something called a mini lab on conservation assured tiger standards. Am I right? Or what was that focused on?
Okay, so conservation assured tiger standards is basically an international accreditation scheme. It looks at the management effectiveness of a park managed for tigers. So it has, you know, standards that will be able to tell a manager, you know, whether you're achieving or moving towards trying to save tigers in the park. So, for example, if you have enough staffing, whether your enactment is, your regulations are in place, whether you have enough protection. So, I mean, some of these elements needs to be assessed in terms of managing a park. If not, you wouldn't know where you are in terms of trying to increase tiger numbers. And so this has been rolled out in other countries, like, for example, in Nepal, India and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So Chitwan National Park, for example, was the first park that was accredited, and, you know, basically that protection level is just so good, and tiger numbers are basically increasing that park. It's a tool.
That's okay.
And it's supposed to basically guide you to see if you are able to meet those standards. And for Malaysia, the Royal Bloom State Park became the first park in Southeast Asia to register for this scheme. It's a good start. We've pretty much done the first gap assessment now, and so we know what our gaps are in that park. The next step is to basically try to find the funding basically to fill those gaps. Besides the accreditation scheme, the standards that we discussed about, we also managed to invite the Nepali army and police, because in Nepal, they've managed to achieve zero poaching.
Mm.
So we wanted to get them here to basically try to explain how did they do it in Nepal. And it's basically a good effort to emulate from the Malaysian side. Because, I mean, they've got their army patrolling the areas and they don't have enough enforcement people as well, but they're getting the army to actually help out. The police also, does a lot of intelligence-based gathering. So that helps them in terms of trying to reduce poaching in that area. So I think this is something that Malaysia can basically emulate.
That was just part of the interview with Dr. Mark Ryan Damaraj, who spearheads the WWF's Tiger Landscape. And he joined us back in July in conjunction with Global Tiger Day. You can find that interview as well at bfm.my/earth. That's it for this episode, but we'll have more best ofs next week. And as always, to search for any Earth Matters podcasts, you can head to bfm.my/earth, or you can download the episodes from our BFM app, available on Google Play, the App Store, and now you can also find us on Spotify. This has been Earth Matters on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.